Miriam Meets on RTE Radio 1 with Miriam O'Callaghan.
This St. Patrick's morning, we bring you a great musical treat. Julie Feeney is a critically acclaimed and award-winning singer, composer, conductor and performer. Her current album is called Clocks and has already been named Irish Times Album of the Year in 2012. Her friend is Cormac Tabara. He is an accomplished Irish harper, composes his own music and engages this most traditional of Irish instruments with Judy's contemporary sound. And they're both joining me for some chat and music. The great thing is you're going to play live for me, both of you, and sing.
Yes, that's right. Yep.
First of all, where did you meet?
I was conducting in Liverpool. It was a Moya concert and Cormac plays with Moya.
We were doing a recording for a live album for Moya called Heartstrings, and Julie had arranged all of Moya's songs, and many of them anyway, for the string section of the Liverpool Phil, and we all just piled into the Liverpool Philharmonic Hall, and that's where we met. And that night we got to chatting.
I think we were sort of a little bit not wary of one another, but we were sort of eyeing one another up.
Well, I'd heard your name for years, because my cousin Maeve used to sing with you in Christchurch Choir years ago. So see, Ireland is so small, you can go nowhere. You know, that's the thing.
All the connections.
I tell you, it's mad, isn't it?
How long ago was that?
5 years, 6 years, maybe 5 years. It's 5 years ago, anyway.
Is it?
For sure.
It was 2010.
No, that was early. No, Heartstrings was recorded in 2006 or 7, so it's a long time ago now.
So how soon after you both met did you start working together?
I basically called up Cormac on New Year's Day.
It was New Year's Day. 3 years ago now, is it?
Yeah. 3 years ago, and basically asked him, would he play? Because I wanted to try and scale down my operation, because I couldn't continue to have a huge number of instruments in every performance, so I wanted to get a brilliant musician who played either the keyboard, the harp, guitar, and sang. And obviously Cormac was popped into my head straight away. So I sent you the album.
Pages. It was a stunning, stunning piece of work. So I rang it straight back going, yep.
Well, normally most of the other musicians I have are classical musicians, which obviously Cormac is as well. But I write everything. So I write all the dots for all the parts. But Cormac picks it all up from the albums by ear. And I mean, I give him obviously some scores, but
what I said to her was, it was like, leave me at it for a day. I'd rather not work straight from the dots. Give me the music first and then see what I'm dropping out and what I'm missing out. And then she put manners on me. Then it's great.
And you go loads of places together now, don't you? Like, you're heading to New York.
That's right. We have performed. I mean, we just recently performed in LA for where Steven Spielberg was there, which was amazing.
How cool was that?
That was stunning. Oh, J.J. Abrams, who did Star Trek and everything, and Lost, he was there too. And
that was pretty.
And Colin Farrell was sitting down beside you, chatting for ages.
That's right.
Tell me about that. Was that the Oscars party?
It was the Oscars party, the Ireland Alliance Oscars party. And so I didn't know that Steven Spielberg was going to be there, but I do my normal thing. I walk around when I sing, and I noticed this man with a baseball cap and glasses and his iPhone in front of him filming me as I was performing. And halfway through that kind of verse, I realised that's Steven Spielberg filming me on his iPhone.
Then so afterwards, you appeared in a Steven Spielberg film.
Yeah, so then he afterwards took a photo of me and J.J. Abrams, and it was just surreal because it was a total surprise. And the fact that I discovered in the middle of my performance, you know, I always go into the audience when I love that. But that was really, I mean, that knocked everything else out of the water. I never expected that would happen.
But I mean, it must be extraordinary to have Steven Spielberg filming you.
On his iPhone.
On his iPhone.
It was mad. It was great.
It's so, you know, you want to film. If you take out your iPhone, you want to film whatever it is.
Yeah.
You know, so that was very surreal. And
but surreal was from the very first minute we played together. Like, the first gig we ever did was in a shop window in Dawson Street. Was it National Hearing Awareness Week?
And then you ended up on the 6-1 News, the very first show.
The first show we ever did, from a shop window. And then the next big one was live at T5, Terminal 5 in JFK on St. Patrick's Day. This day 2 years ago, probably.
Yes. It was headlining the live at T5. It was great. It was in the middle of the terminal. So did the same thing again. Went around to all the random passers-by.
And when you travel together, what's it like?
When you're touring, part of the thing, ideally, if you can have somebody as brilliant a musician as Cormac and as great fun and a pal, but it's just somebody who's good to tour with. You know, you need to be up for things. You need to be adaptable. you know, you need to be able
no
to
drama,
just,
no stress. Yeah,
no, not drama. No. And, you know, you no just rows. Need someone to get on with it. Yeah.
But he obviously, you're not afraid of strong women, which is a nice trait in a man.
Oh, it's great. I've been around them all my life. My grandmother was my first and my mother. They're all strong forces in my life.
No, no. But he's kind of assertive too. You know what I mean? He's not like he just says yes, yes, yes to everything. You know.
We pick the people we go with because we get on. I think you find in life, you do find the people you spark off and the people you relate to. You can tell from the first time you meet someone really that you're going to have a good time with them or it's going to be difficult. And you know, how lucky to have nobody that I work with that I don't get on with. You know, it's a jammy job, as they say.
But I suppose both of you are also incredibly musically talented. So there's a friendship, but then there's a mutual respect, I suppose, for what you both do.
There's a respect for the mutual passion that we have for what we do. Because if you do what we do full time, this is what your living is. You know, you've already signed up for that and that's what you're doing for a living. And so you're speaking to somebody who understands you completely, you know.
And look, we're going to take the first piece of music, which I think, was this the one that Spielberg filmed, by the way, Impossibly Beautiful? Didn't you sing this at the Oscar party?
Yeah, yeah. I still...
I'll get my iPhone out now.
I'm reliving it.
She came over to me after the meeting. I was in the middle of singing this and I looked up and I was singing to somebody's face and it was Steven Spielberg. Because Impossibly Beautiful into his face. It's great.
And a big smile on him.
Oh, well, look, he's not here today.
No, he's not.
But if you would both go over
I'll give
now,
you a baseball cap.
Oh, you give me a baseball cap and you're going to accompany
Judy
and together and Impossibly Beautiful, which you wrote yourself, didn't you?
Oh yeah, I write all my music, yeah.
It's beautiful. Let's listen to it and then we'll talk about it.
You're impossibly beautiful. Is that cause I'm waiting? Is that cause I'm looking? Or is it just cause you are? You're impossibly beautiful. Is that cause I'm waiting? Is that cause I'm looking? Or is it just cause you are? You're impossibly beautiful, is that cause I'm waiting? Is that cause I'm looking, or is it just cause you are?
Oh, what a beautiful song, Come Back Over. I'm not surprised Steven Spielberg was filming you. Why did you write that song and what's it about?
I've always been obsessed with, or plagued with, the whole idea of beauty. Whether if we feel we should look better ourselves or what beauty is, and it ties in with jealousy if somebody feels that they're not, you know, insecurities and all the whole area. So I really wanted to write something about beauty. The words are actually not quite as sweet as the melody sounds. People really respond to the music and the melody of it and they just kind of think, oh yeah, yes, you're impossibly beautiful. But actually it's, you know, it's a little bit more edgy inside if you look at the words, you know.
Would it take you long to write a song like that?
What I normally do is I go away for a number of weeks and I just work on words. So that was in a period of 6 weeks where I would make sure that I had, for that album, was 12 poems. So I'll have the words all kind of carved out and chopped up, and I'll gather all my thought copies that I have thought copies all the time that I collect, and I'll tear up into different pieces of paper and I'll put them into different categories. I have a whole kind of process that I do. And then I'll end up with a sort of a basket of ideas and phrases and words. And then I kind of mesh whatever I want to mesh together. And then when I put the music with that, some comes out, some goes back in again. It's a sort of like a kneading. It's like kind of making a cake or something. Mm-hmm. And then it takes quite a while. Yeah. And then, I mean, that's just the words and the melody. And then after that is the orchestration, which is a whole separate thing after that. You know, I get ideas really quickly and I get them very regularly. I've no problem with getting ideas, but it's the cooking part and the decisions about how to present something. Because you can present a song in so many different ways. Mm. So it's the crafting around it that takes the time.
Because there's a real theatricality to your performances as well. I mean, you're not just a singer and a songwriter.
Mm-hmm. Now I like my performances to be like an event as much as possible. My job is to entertain people for the evening. And if I haven't done that, then I've failed. I used to be a little bit more muso-ish. My first album, you just be kind of playing your songs and, oh, yes, well, that's a G, whatever, 7 and a 6, and thinking you're great, you know, but it's a little bit up your posterior to be that way. I think there's no harm in just saying, you know what, I just actually want to uplift people, and you've spent so much time on words and the song and the melody, like you want to bring them in then as well in the performance.
But that's kind of why we got on so well, because you had gone, if you had been just the muso person, like, you know, I need this G7 to be in the second barrier all the time, I would never, like, there are some songs that are so exact, but there is a little room for interpretation within that,
some
of them. And that's why we get on so well. And the sign of a good song is if you can reinterpret it. You know, if a song needs to be exactly that always, then it's within, it's just, it's locked in. But if a song can live through different arrangements and even transfer from the orchestra down to one or two instruments and carry on just as well. And I've been trying to convince her that she can do it with two people.
But the harp is beautiful. Even listening to you here this morning playing it, and you're going to play in a moment a piece just yourself. Cormac, tell me about your background, how you ended up playing the harp.
Well, I'm from Dublin, but the family's all from Cork. My mother's side are from the Gaeltacht in West Cork, and my dad's side are Cork City. But they all had music on both sides. And I just assumed it was the norm that everybody had a grandmother who played the harp and sang, and my mother plays and my aunts play, and my grandaunt was Máirín Fertur, Máirín Níhé, who taught at Sion Hill. So she would have been responsible for Kathleen Watkins and Mary O'Hara and Deirdre O'Callaghan and all that brigade of harpers.
Brilliant harpers,
they're great.
Yeah.
Well, they were, you know, of their time, yeah. They made a huge inroad into a tradition that was dying nearly, you know. So I just picked it up at home, and my grandmother would have been travelling, and we went to the Celtic Congress and to these Lorient Celtic festivals and everything as kids, and we had a group on our own, and we would write stuff and we would play, and just basically it was the way we grew up. There were sessions at home, there was singing, you name it, it was happening. My grandmother loved Breton and Welsh and spoke them fluently, and so the songs were either in Welsh or Irish or Gaelic and Scots Gaelic or in Breton. And I just took this as normal that my grandmother would simultaneously translate bedtime stories from Welsh to Irish, because I didn't speak English till I was five, even up in Clonskeagh and Ranelagh where we grew up. But kind of strange, I suppose, looking back. It was a strange upbringing.
Though.
But you know, it's weird that you don't, once you travel, you realise what you have at home. That entire generation is now gone, and luckily we did have enough time to cop that. If we don't take this now, when they go, it dies with them. Mm. The stuff that is surrounding you when you're a child, you really have to repeat it, take it in, and take it with you. And that's what I did with the harp. Luckily, you know, I was lucky to get it. You know?
And the piece you're going to play for us now, Cormac, tell me about it, Mr. O'Connor. It involves your grandmother again, doesn't it?
It does. Well, she was the presenter of Dilly No Douse on television. I'm sure any kids in the 80s remember Dilly No Douse. We were the kids around that. So I grew up looking at this harp, and this was what I took up. And she put me into the Fesh Coil, which I used to hate because it was such a nerve-wracking experience. But she arranged this piece especially for me, for the Fesh. And it was for the O'Carolan Cup in the Fesh Coil. And it's a lucky piece for me. I played it, I was in Japan for 6 months playing when I was 17. And it's the first piece I played there. And I was playing for the Emperor and Empress of Japan in the palace in Tokyo.
It's nearly as good as Steven Spielberg.
Well, not quite. But it was like, it's a lucky piece. It's the piece that I always bring with me. And it was the one that she arranged especially for a thing that I won that sent me off to Japan. It got me going, really, and the harp in the big bad world. And so that's why I love it. I do. It's with me since I started, really. So.
Okay, well, you go over there now and you're going to play Mr. O'Connor.
That's Mr. O'Connor, yeah.
Carolan. Lovely. I can see why you love it. Mr. O'Connor, Carolan's. That harp is beautiful.
It's a new harp. It's only about 10 years old. It's a replica of my grandmother's harp, which was built in 1902 in Belfast by a man called James MacFall. And we always thought it was a very rare instrument, but all the convents in Ireland apparently have harps sitting in the corner, all made by this James MacFall from Belfast. But my great-grandfather bought all of his daughter's harps. He was a man called Sean P. O'Shea, and if anyone did Peg in school, God help them.
We did.
One of Peg's daughters went up to Dublin in Aimshire to Sean P. O'Shea in Dundrumma. That was my great-grandfather. And so he got lucky anyway, living in Birmingham, made a bit of money, came home and raised his six children, speaking Irish and playing harps and everything. And the five girls got to play them, and my uncle Finn had to carry them around for the girls. That was his job. But yeah, so that's why. And Maureen then had the harp school kind of thing. And my first harp was given to me by Maureen. I used to trot up to her house every week to play Thordum de Love, just to kind of finagle a harp out of her. And then she had nine harps and I had none at home.
Nine harps?
She had nine of them. And then I coveted one, so I got it. And then when I got my own harp, then I passed that on to my cousin Aoife. So hopefully she'll keep the tradition going a bit.
Well, that's really interesting. Tell me about your background, Judy, where all the music talent comes from.
Yeah, there's music on both sides. My mother's parents, both of them were beautiful singers. I never heard them. And there would have been traditional music on the other side. My mother played the organ in Abbeynockmoy. It was definitely in the blood. I mean, all my family are very musical. They actually are really good singers. They would laugh at me if they heard me saying that, but they really have beautiful voices, and they have that kind of thing where, you know, when people in the same family have that lovely blend that kind of works, they have that. It's beautiful. We were brought to all kinds of lessons for everything, clarinet, violin, every instrument that you could possibly want to play. Like, we were exposed to everything. Yeah, countryside, very much.
What part of the countryside?
Between Athenry and Abinacmoy. Green fields, an awful lot of memories of, we used to go running in the morning really early. My brothers and I, we used to do this, you know, jogging thing. Lots of cycles in the countryside. And the primary school I went to in Abinacmoy, a beautiful school that had a big old tree outside. And there was a forest beside it, and there was a river that you could hear. I loved actually growing up in the countryside.
When did you decide, and how big a decision was it, to go into music full time? Because it was late enough on, wasn't it, when you said, I'm going to do this full time?
Well, I decided first after school that I would study it. But then I wanted to kind of take in the other things that I needed to do. So I wanted to do psychoanalysis and psychology.
As you do.
As these things. Because I kind of wanted to hoover up all these experiences and all that kind of thing. But to actually make it my full-time career, yeah, that's a whole different thing. It's a very hard thing to say, yes, I'm going to do this as a full-time career. Are you good enough to do it? It was one thing. Or have you accumulated enough experience? Have you got whatever it is that you do? So when I realised making my living out of my own music that I write and compose and arrange is actually what I want to do. And I remember, going into the National Chamber Choir and kind of handing my notice in and saying, yeah, I want to kind of do this. And I didn't really have a plan, but I got nominated for the Choice Music Prize like 6 days later, and then I won it, and then I got signed and all that. But I do think that when you kind of know in your heart, you kind of realise that, yes, I think I can actually do this, you have to take that jump then. And you, with your upbringing, everybody's always saying something to fall back on. You have but like, if you have something to fall back on, you probably will fall back on it, you know. And so it's kind of a dangerous thing to have. I know I have a good number of things I could possibly fall back on, but no, it's too late now. I've already taken the job.
I don't see you as a psychoanalyst. No. I don't see you as a psychoanalyst.
Yeah, I mean, maybe like years down the line, like I would, like also with psychoanalysis, you don't know anything when you're in college. I don't think anyway. Yeah. You have to actually live life,
best
I think. I don't mean to down psychoanalysts all around the country.
You can psychoanalyse Cormac when you're
there
on the road
go.
Together.
That would be very interesting.
Good luck, yeah. There's a lot in there now to be trying to deal with.
When did you decide that you could do music as a full-time career?
I handed my notice in the same kind of way as Judy, but I took a different tack altogether. I never did music as a full-time study. But I did media in college, so I ended up working in RT and in T and the G, as it was at the beginning. And I was sort of full-time in that. And Hazel O'Connor and myself did a show at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, her life story called Beyond Breaking Glass. And I was doing some little acting parts as well. And we got 5 stars in the Scotsman, and we got to move around. We got some tours out of it. And just that career was getting in the way of music. So I had to make a call on which one was better. And then I got the Frontier Films credit card for No Frontiers as a researcher on the travel show. And I had it 2 weeks in my hand, and I handed it back to Gerard going, thanks a million, but I'm going on the road with Hazel. And we went to LA, went to New York. So you kind of make the call. You kind of go, do I do this or do I not? And then I just said, you know what? You have to just take the leap.
Yeah, it's kind of a scary jump, but...
But if you enjoy what you do, like I'm just thinking back about the Oscar party and, Julie, you invest everything. And that taught me a lot. That Oscar party, everyone talks all night long. Nobody listens to them. And the word was, like, nobody's going to listen to you. And within the first 30 seconds, Julie had them kind of listening. And by the end of the second or third song, when it finished, the applause happened, and then there was dead silence. They were all fixated.
In other words, she'd made such an impression.
She'd captured the entire place. And that's the thing with people who do that. And like probably the rudest of all audiences in a way would be an Oscar audience, party, because they're there to have fun. They're surrounded by A-listers all the time. They don't need anyone. No, they're not, impressed easily. But she had them completely. That's the difference between sort of musician and an A-list performer.
A star,
you know?
Really?
Exactly, yeah, that's the thing, you know.
And do you find that difficult to do, Julie? Like at that Oscar party, maybe an issue when people aren't listening. Do you get a moment of nervousness, or do you just say, I'm going to go for this?
Just before, I was a bit distracted, I will say, because I was talking to Colin Farrell just before.
That is distracting.
He was holding your hand, Julie Feeney.
I know, listen.
He never had my hand.
He's a really, really nice guy. I mean, I'm actually kind of joking.
He's a lovely guy.
He's very normal guy.
No, he was brilliant. He's such an earth, down-to-earth kind of
guy,
you know.
Yeah, he's lovely. The nerves are unbelievable, but there's something that just happens when you start. Yeah. You can't even explain it. And then you are completely there and you are nowhere else. You're totally present. And I think once you know what that feels like, you just push yourself in there. You just give absolutely everything. You don't care, so you don't feel the pain of your high heels. You don't feel, you know, you might, even if you fall, like I fell in New York. I did 10 nights in New York, and one night I fell because I was running around and I banged my head and I banged everything and the microphone. The only thing I was worried about was the microphone.
This is my own your microphone. Head is fine.
Yeah, the head will be grand. And I didn't even feel the pain because, if you know, you're, and I wasn't even bruised afterwards because I must, you know, I think the power of the mind.
Yeah,
it's really
a different zone.
I think people connect with that zone. I think what it is when you invest everything of you in your performance, people actually gravitate to that because it's true. It's truth. You know, it's like it's real and they grab it and they go away really entertained and really feeling better about the day. And it's you know, what a thing to be making a living.
Because then they realise the artist has given all of themselves, you know, it's a gratitude.
And hearing them sing back the songs that you've written, I've read with, the first time I ever heard anything I'd ever written with anyone. I mostly co-write more than doing it. But when you hear them coming back and you kind of go, that's something we kind of put together. And they're now, they've taken it away and they're bringing it back. And you had them all singing some of the songs off the new album. Yeah,
that's
Dear
right.
John.
Dear John. And
she got the entire Oscar audience to sing her songs.
Which brings us to Dear John, because we're going to listen to that track now, which is Off Clocks. Tell me about the song.
I was very charmed when I heard, I did a lot of research in my family tree for Clocks, six generations Galwegian at least.
Excellent.
Yeah. So, but I was doing all this, did all this research and heard a story that my grandparents would wait for the moonlit night before they went for a cycle, to cycle over to the next house for the tea, for the spread and the chat and listening to the radio and all that kind of. And it just totally charmed. I just couldn't get it out of my head. So I thought I definitely have to have that in a song. So my grandfather, his name is John, and his wife, Annie. And I composed Dear John. I just thought, imagine you'd wait. Well, they obviously wanted to wait for it was safer to cycle in that, or they must have just liked it. You know, it's like slowing down. Today's so fast and iPhones, we can't do things fast enough. But I just thought, wow, imagine when things were that slow and that the beauty of it. And I could feel the air because I love, as I say, growing up in the countryside, I love the feel of the night air. There's nothing like it. It's just this crisp thing. It kind of bites your face in a really nice way, and the smell of the air, and I could hear the wheels on the kind of gravel on the road and all of that. Well, I wanted to go into that world, so that's what all the words are about. You know, you revel in the spell of the beating, pleasing stroke of country air and all that sort of stuff.
We're going to take that song, Dear John, you wrote about your grandfather.
Mm-hmm.
It's beautiful.
Country air, and you reveled in the spell of the echoes, then to hush the velvet pair. What is going to be like?
Dear John, there, beautiful song that you wrote about your grandfather.
Thank you.
And the six generations of Galwegians in your family, is that important to you?
It would be important to me, the fact that I can trace back that far. I do love being from Galway, very much so. I'd love to try and find something a little bit more exotic, like the Aran Islands, maybe.
maybe you keep
or
going
even
back.
Connemara.
Your dream amazing. Come true.
Yeah. It would be amazing. Like,
so are the six generations of your family all from around where you grew up in Galway?
No, it's all different parts. Over from Tuam, across the whole way, you know, sort of Abinach Mhoy, kind of over to Athenry, but they weren't even really actually the town or anything like that. But I'm really trying to go back as far as I can, you know. So it's different parts.
Why are you so interested?
I'm absolutely intrigued. I've always been intrigued by it. I mean, I've done DNA tests and everything.
She's hilarious. You do it,
yeah, you do it on your mother's side. You go back to your mother's 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 mother. And if you do it on the male side, it's a family finder thing it's called. But I get emails all the time from people in America. Hi, it looks like I'm your fourth cousin. I've done the DNA. And this would have been my great-great-great-grandmother, who's a widower. She'd had a family before she married my relative.
Didn't you find them in Maine?
And then,
in Maine.
And then basically her two sons had gone to America. And this guy that's writing to me is a descendant of those people. And he's, you know, so he's only half fifth cousin or something.
It's enough
like
for
that.
The Americans. They love it anyway.
So, Cormac, have you any interest in tracing your generation?
I do, but there's an awful lot of kind of turbulence in the past. Well,
that's interesting.
It was my great grandfather and his brother. They were put in Spike Island because they were fighting against the Brits at the time, as they say. They were all very revolutionary, rebel Cork, you know, standard.
Yeah, that's fine.
The rebel county and all that. But they were both in Spike Island, and my great grand uncle Con escaped, and there was he had a death sentence over his head, so he went off to America, and there was a bit of black and tan. I think they broke into my great grandfather's house at some point, so something's happened then, and nobody ever talked about it. The Cork, they all just shut down. There's a terrible thing with the Cork
generation
side.
They just wouldn't talk.
And I'd love to know how much further back, you know, obviously it's easily traceable. They were from Kilnamartra beside Coolay in Cork. So I'm sure if I go back, but nobody of my family, they all moved to Dublin. Not one of them is ever, you know, I have no first cousins or the third cousins or the first gang I could find in Cork. So it's kind of, we're disjointed. We're homeless people.
You could get Julie on the case.
I think
she could trace it for you.
My agent.
Well, you can, I mean, it is unbelievable what you can find out yourself. You need to go to the graveyards as well. And I've photographed.
You need a lot of time.
Well, it's really, really strange. I was composing my opera and making clocks and doing the 10 choir. I did a big, huge tour with 10 choirs. I don't know how, but I found time to do this.
I
went around to my mother.
If you want to do something, you can make the time.
We would drove around to all the different places where her family would have come from. And it's just really enjoyable. Yeah. It's really, really interesting. And you actually stand in this place or this old house where you know your great grandparents came from, and you just imagine them walking out. They walked out that gate there, and they met that person who met, and then you kind of come from that. And it's kind of blows my mind, actually.
All of mine are O'Tuama to me. They're all O'Tuama, so there's like every other person in that part of Cork is O'Tuama. So I think they might not be related. If I go to the graveyard, I think I've discovered a whole treasure trove, and they're all nothing to do with us.
What's the dynamic of your relationship? Like, does everyone think you're an item when you go around together?
Don't think so.
I don't think that's happened. Well, I suppose, I don't.
If you're away. Really, because you're lugging stuff around. I mean, I'm lugging
it. It's happened to me with other people that I work with, I have to say, because I work with quite a few, with all these strong women
strong
I work
women.
With. I know that, and with Hazel, often I've been mistaken. They think now, well, you work so well together on stage, there has to be something more to it. And they're convinced that there's more to it. And of course, there can't be anything more to it.
Because you're not that way inclined,
I'm not inclined towards the ladies, the as they say.
Dortlum, tell me what your mother said about being hanging around with all these women
on Fyke Farm. She goes, Fyke Farm, find a good husband, she says to me.
Did she mind at all when she discovered you were gay?
No, it was very funny. I mean, we were such a crazy family, so I think that was the least of her worries, you know, in terms of everyone
lovely
around
family,
her.
By the sound of
we're so close, it's great, and we all play music, and we all play together, and we all play in different bands together. But no, I was coming home full of the joys of spring when I was, what, I was 20. I was coming home, big smile on my face, no sign of me all night long. I was coming in the morning every day, like for a whole summer. And eventually she stopped me in the hallway one morning. She goes, Cormac, will to sasta? And she goes, Tom, on the horse now. I says, Ni Kailina town. That was her way. Sure, Ni Kailina. So it's not a girl, is it? Is it? No, I went, I took a deep breath. I went, okay, Ni Ha. I said, Ni Ha. And that was it. That was like,
Shine.
And of course, Shine Dirich. But then we went off to Lorient, to the Celtic festival in the August of that summer. And I came home. And I think anybody who asked, "Come to Cormac?" She'd have, "Well, wait till I tell you."
Because great gossip.
When I came, because even Auntie Maura, who was from Cormac, she goes, "Cormac, time ago here, the hon." She was praying for me. I went, "Okay." And then about a week later, the penny dropped why she'd said that to me. I said, "Hi, ma'am, when anybody asked, she must have just said, well, wait till I tell you now. He's just come up." You know? So she basically outed me. I didn't have to do anything.
She did it. But isn't that great about Ireland as well, though, that people have changed so much that it doesn't matter?
It's amazing how I think we kind of copped on. My dad was great too. He was doing this thing with me once we were doing a show together on the Breton laws, and apparently in the old days there was no issue at all. Everything just happened and people just took all at face value. I think we're returning to our own
the
psyche.
Way we were.
Yeah, and that the way that people just go, don't do wrong, don't do bad by anyone else. If you're not harming anyone and if you're not doing anything, what's the problem?
Yeah,
and that's
nobody's
the thing.
Business. But is it difficult when you're on the road as much as you are, Julie, to have a personal life, to have a romantic life?
The good thing about what I do is that you actually can make your own schedule I spend a lot of my time composing. I can really design my week myself. Yeah. I can kind of work from anywhere as well. I can work, go home and work from in Galway or work in Dublin. So it's actually much more flexible.
So do you both have a special person in your lives or not?
I've nobody particular at the moment.
Particular?
So, no, I know I don't. No is the answer to me.
And you do?
I'm very happy. That's what I'll say.
But I think I'm going to take that as a yes.
That's Julie in a nutshell. She's brilliant. She will give you the answer without giving you the answer, and she'll have and she'll write us. Her next album will be about that or something like.
Yeah,
wait
it's good though. It's nice. I'm taking it.
It's brilliant.
From it.
I'm jealous.
But your mother still has to await you finding on far jazz.
On far jazz, she is Cá Bhfuil sé.
Cá Bhfuil sé. Beidh Cá Bhfuil sé agus tuigh tú níos.
Ní bheadh is agat.
Julie, we're going to take another song of yours, which is Julia.
Yeah, I composed this. My grandfather was a beautiful singer on my mother's side, and he was asked why didn't he sing anymore after his wife died, after Julia died, and he said he had nothing to sing about. So when I heard that story, I just thought, oh my goodness. So I wanted to compose this and make it as, you know, sad as I could possibly make it. So it's basically him. You know, it sounds a bit funny to make it really sad, but it's basically
how sad
him.
Can you make it?
Well, I mean, it just broke my heart, and I find it really hard to sing it if I even think of who it's about. So it's basically him singing to her after she'd passed on in Abhinach Mhaoi, because he was absolutely heartbroken. So it's just straight out, I just love you and I miss you.
As I cry out to the river, Julia, Julia,
Julia, that is a really sad song.
It is, yeah. No, it is. Actually, when I perform it live, I probably shouldn't tell people what it's about, because I have had reactions all right live.
Cheers.
From it. The first night I performed it actually live was in New York, and my mother was in the audience, and it's about her mom and dad. So I actually found that really hard. I didn't perform it very well because it's your voice. So it's emotion. That's where the first place it comes out.
One of those things with songs like that is that people, when they do respond with it, it brings out an emotion that they want to let go. And if you release it in them, usually they're happy. They think it's great when that happens.
Yeah, you can connect into people's emotions. Yeah.
It can be. I mean, I've had cases when I perform, when people do get very upset, say at the end, and they come up talking to you. I don't know them and they don't know me, and it's just through the song that they've connected. So I keep it, you know, I speak about the song as much as I can, and just always talk, because like you have to make sure that it's talked out. You don't want to leave somebody going off out the door upset.
But it shows you, it's the power of a song.
Yeah, you just have to be kind of responsible about it. You can't just be flippant, I think. As a performer or as a writer, you actually wrote this. You made them feel that way, so you should take responsibility for it.
But like, you're heading off to New York now. How great is that?
We are, again.
I'm releasing Clocks in New York, and also in the UK and in Germany.
Myself and Maya have a new album coming out.
I'm composing an opera that's going to be going into production fairly soon. It's called Bird. I'm doing a show in the National Concert Hall. It's a certain orchestra that I'll be performing with, a well-known orchestra.
It's just the way you say, I'm composing an opera, like, hello?
Just like that.
Just like that. Have you ever composed an opera before?
No, this is my first opera. It's a totally different...
How do you start composing an opera? Like, where do you begin?
You start and then you start again and start again and start again. That's what I have found about it. I'm now... I performed 20 minutes of it last year, and I asked the second it was over, I just said, I'm rewriting all of it. It's just, you know, totally, because you keep doing that with an opera. So I'm reimagining the story, completely writing my own. It's not my own story, based on an Oscar Wilde story. It's more inspired by at this point. So I'm basically writing a really long poem and telling a story through music.
And it's getting raunchy, I believe.
It's kind of dark now. It's a tragic.
But there are lots of operas are tragic, and they're all raunch, and it's perfect. Yeah. It sounds like it's like a riveting opera, I think, from the bits. She doesn't give you much. Doesn't give you much of a hint either.
No.
When we were recording the album, I only got to hear one or two of the tracks. I wasn't even allowed to hear the whole album. So until it's ready, which is a great thing, because you wait till you're happy with it before it goes out there. You know,
I suppose that's the nature of, because you're running your own thing. You want to make sure that this is what I'm happy with. There you go. Now you can do whatever you like with.
Are you a hard task master for yourself? In other words. Do you give yourself a hard time?
Well, yeah. I mean, pretty much I like to reach a standard, definitely. And say if you've worked a lot of time on an orchestration or arrangement, I definitely like to keep that, you know. But then it's also important to grow and develop, and you get that through performing live. and you twist things around much more and more. But yeah, no, I would be definitely. I think the best thing is if you have worked as hard as you possibly can, then you know you've done everything. And then you can be flexible after that.
And she, she wouldn't let you see it till it's finished. But she had some of the tracks I was playing on clocks, you know, like I heard nothing, only the one line. I said, Julie, I'll have to hear a little more. If you wouldn't mind, I have to play with that bass line. If you wouldn't mind, just can I hear it? You know, she went, no. And it was great. But it's part of the fun, you know.
But I can see watching the two of you here today as we close that you love playing together because you're going to play one last one for us now and that you enjoy yourselves. And it's actually, although it can be tough, must be a real pleasure to do what you do in life since you both love music.
There's nothing better. I mean, it's just absolutely exhilarating.
And how lucky to be doing that and making a living from it, whatever, scraping a living, something. But it's I'd rather do that and make half the money or a quarter of the money and do something that I'd be stuck in that. Like, is that uni? I've given up a few jobs, and you have two jobs that would have paid better, you know. But there's no fun in it unless you can.
No,
you
go but also so life.
Yeah, there is. But also for me, I will invest into a music video or invest into a costume or something. I put it all back in again, you know. And it's just better. It makes the shiny thing.
Yeah,
keep shinier.
I bought 5 harps, so it's the same without the costumes. So it's the same.
Have you got 5 harps?
I have 7. I inherited my grandmother's harp.
So do you live in a mansion? Where are all your harps?
No, I live with a wonderful woman called Maureen Simpson. She's in London all the time, so I'm a lodger.
With all the harps.
For the harps, yes. I have my grandmother's harp, that one. I have my little wire strung harp. I have Christopher Casson, the wonderful Christopher Casson, the actor. His harp came to me, so I have a little...
Right, harp collection.
Harpo.
But listen, we're going to go out in a song, Knock Knock.
Mm. That's right.
Tell me about this.
It's about love. It's about that moment when yet again you find yourself in love. Knock Knock, it's here again. Just that moment. It's probably, you know, in various relationships, it's that like, oh no, I'm hooked. Oh goodness. It's kind of, I know there's going to be disaster ahead.
Is it autobiographical?
At the time it was, yeah. It was the second last album.
And it also is one of the things that on Pages, it was a beautiful, beautiful final song on the album, and we got to play. We got our own. This is a different version of it because it's not got the ensemble. The whole string section is there, so we got to reinterpret the song a little. And it's such a that was the first song that really got. When I remember the first
you
time we sat down.
You keep going on about that.
I know. I'm sorry, but
I
harp on about it.
You're like a married couple now. But look, it's my pleasure having both of you this morning.
Totally
Julie Feeney and Cormac Tabara. And if there is a nice bar, Jessica Geistucht, well, and he likes harps, that would be great.
My website.
But best of luck in New York and with everything you do in both of your careers. You go over now and we're going to play Knock Knock. My thanks on sound today to Noel Roberts, to my producer Eileen Herron. We'll be here at the same time next Sunday. But for now, we go out listening to Julie Feeney and Cormac Tabara with Knock Knock.
With innocent eyes and expectant faces, momentary amnesia, lured by graces and perils forgotten in the heart embraces, knock, knock, it's here again.
Miriam Meets on RTE Radio 1. Listen back or podcast at rte.ie/radioplayer.